Good morning. The subject is about the preacher and his wife, and a smart preacher, when he came in, would have sat next to his wife. She's right here. Maybe I'll have a second chance with regard to that. I am well aware of the smell of the brisket and the barbecue. Oh, it smells so good. I was with Perry Cotham a couple of years ago on a program, and somehow somebody had gotten off the schedule. They'd gone too long. And it was about, the lunch was going to be at noon, and it was about 10:15 till when Brother Cotham was introduced. And he originally had had 30 minutes. Now, if you have ever been with Brother Cotham at a place, you realize there are several things to be true about him, and one of them is that he's usually near the front of the line when it's time to eat. And Brother Cotham was preaching an impassioned lesson. I was amazed, enthralled. And about 10 minutes into it, he looked at his watch and said, "It's time to eat." Got out, walked, and was the first in line that day. So I will keep my eye on the clock, and I'll know when it's time to quit. Ananias and Sapphira are mentioned in five distinct contexts. You will read about them in Acts chapter 18, verse 2 through 4. You'll read them about them again in Acts 18, verse 24 through 28. Again, they appear in Romans chapter 16 and verse 4. Again, in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 19. One more time at the end of Paul's life and writings in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 19. And in these passages, we learn some very informative and important things about this particular husband and wife. Over there in Acts chapter 18 and verse 2, we see that they had been through trials together. They had been made to leave their home city because of a persecution that we read about there in that context. Another thing that we see is in Acts chapter 18 and verse 3, and that is that they work together in the same profession. That'll be noteworthy to us. A third thing that we notice is that they were fellow workers together in soul winning. And they were both willing, and they were both able, and apparently they were a great team at it, as we see the one that they taught in Acts chapter 18 and verse 26 particularly. A fourth thing we see about them from these contexts is that they were of one mind in suffering for Christ, having risked their necks for the brotherhood. That we see in Romans chapter 16 and verse 4. A fifth thing we see is that they were united in their service and in their hospitality. They opened up their home as the church building there in Ephesus, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 19. But the thing that impresses me, and I know it does you too, is that every time we read about them, they're together. They are there together in their home. They're there together in their work. They're there together among the lost, and they're there together among the saints. You know, in training men to preach, sometimes we may say that the church is hiring the man and not his family. In the process of interviewing a man for a preaching position, elders can often say, or the men, if there is no eldership, they will say this, "Now, preacher, we realize that we are not hiring your wife, we're hiring you." And I have found out in 18 years as a preacher's kid, and then in marrying a preacher's kid, and in preaching for nearly 20 years, that statement is absolutely, unequivocally untrue. I have known some men who had great ability, men who I loved to listen to as they preach, and I saw great talent in them, and I saw great potential in them. But I have seen in some cases where some of them have been derailed by unsupportive wives. Sometimes those wives were unprepared for the pressures and the challenges that are unique to the preacher's family. Sometimes their husbands have been negligent toward them in pursuit of their own ministerial goals. And sometimes the wife was introverted, or she was shy, or she struggled with feelings of inadequacy. And that showed itself in different ways. Maybe she felt inadequate as a teacher. Or maybe she felt inadequate in matters of hospitality. Maybe she had never been trained in matters like that. Or maybe it was interpersonal matters, the most difficult of matters that we deal with in ministry. It may be that in that particular thing there were personality conflicts or there were interpersonal matters that were bigger than she was, and she felt unequal to that task. The only way a preacher and his wife are going to weather the storms that can come is by taking those storms together and realizing that ministry is something that is done as a team, both of them together. The denominational preacher's wife by the name of Dorothy Pentecost said, "God has given marriage partners to each other to work together in the task that He has given them to do. This close relationship should be a joy and comfort to all marriage partners, and especially should it give added strength to those who are in ministry. Togetherness in goal and in purpose, togetherness in spiritual growth, togetherness in love, and togetherness in mutual admiration." What I'd like for us to do is to go back and look at Ananias and Sapphira a little bit more closely. And I would like for us to glean some lessons that will help us as preachers and wives as we look at and embrace a life in ministry together. The first thing, and I know I was going to do that. I'm glad you caught that. I'm glad you're listening. It's your fourth lesson of the day. I said, I'm going to say Ananias and Sapphira at least one time. I'm going to see if anybody's watching. No, actually, I just said it wrong. It's Aquila and Priscilla. How many times have I said that? Three. Well, I'm glad nobody's keeping count. You guys, thanks. I'm going to say A and P from now on. Is that all right? Hereafter known as A and P. All right, Aquila. Got it. Now I'm in my own head. Aquila and Priscilla, they were together. Number one, Aquila and Priscilla were together in problems. There is no doubt but the preacher's family is going to encounter a variety of problems in time. Now, some of the problems that a preacher's family are going to encounter are problems that are common to everybody. What are some of the problems that every family encounters? Well, every family is going to go through financial difficulties. Every family is going to have troubles with their cars and troubles with their houses. Every family is going to deal with health issues, especially eventually and as time goes on. And every family is going to deal with extended family issues. We're going to deal with problems with our parents or with our children or our siblings. Those are things that are common to everybody. We're all going to deal with temptation. We're going to deal with depression perhaps and discouragement and disappointment. Now that's something that happens to all of us because we're here on this earth. Now it may be unique to the preacher and his family because there are always going to be members that have an idealistic view of the preacher and his family that they don't have problems or that they shouldn't have problems. That we have this perfect picture of how things ought to be in their family life. But I will say that for all of that, it seems to me that the overwhelming majority of elderships and memberships understand that we're human like everybody else. And there are just some things that are common to all that we are going to go through. But I also suggest to you that there are some things, some problems that are unique to the preacher's family. Now, as we explore some of these, however, I want us to keep in mind that the problems that we read about in Acts chapter 18 and verse 2 that happened with Aquila and Priscilla were not on the basis of their being full-time church workers, but because of their ethnicity. They were Jews, and so they had to leave their city and their home. But what I want us to notice about that is as they were working together, they did not let this problem drive a wedge between them. You know what can happen to us in our lives as preachers and wives? When the problems come that are unique to us as in that profession, those kinds of things can drive us apart if we don't have the right kind of foundation there. Well, what are some of the problems that are unique to us that we need to face together? Let's list a few. Number one, preachers' families' values may be in the minority, even in the local church. Our moral principles and positions. I think I mentioned yesterday that Kathy and I and our family, we won't go to the public beach. We're not going to be there where we see people who are immodestly clothed because we realize that the eyes or a window are a light into our hearts and our souls, and we're not going to allow ourselves to be exposed to things that can put us in a position we don't want to be in. But if we're worth our salt, we're going to be talking about the purity of life that ought to characterize us as the people of God. So we're going to either preach or in private conversations, the matter of modern dancing is going to come up. The matter of social drinking is going to come up. And if we take a biblical stand with regard to these, we're going to find ourselves in the minority. Now, I know it's possible for a preacher and his family not to have convictions with regard to these kind of things, but a great many of us will. And it produces problems. What are we going to do as a couple when we're confronted with those kind of things? Another thing that we may deal with as a preacher's family is we may encounter problems due to our concern for the church. You know, you look at all the things that Paul went through, and Paul wasn't in local work. He was more of a traveling missionary. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he talks about all the beatings that he's taken, and he's talking about all the shipwrecks that he's endured, and the day and the night and the deep. And after all that, he says, in addition to all of this, I have upon me the concern for the church and all the churches. If we're doing what we're supposed to be doing in local work, our lives are going to get intertwined in the lives of the people that we're working with. And when you are a preacher and a preacher's wife, you know a lot more about what's going on in the congregation than the average member does. And if you have a heart, it's going to cause your heart to break. You're going to carry those burdens around in your heart and your life because you love the people that you're ministering to. But number three, preachers' families may be expected to have a perfect marriage and have perfect children. And again, I think of Paul's words in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, and I find them to be very relevant to what we're talking about. He says, who is weak? And I am not weak. We aren't superhuman because we preach. In fact, perhaps we're more reminded than anybody of our frailties because we do preach and we do work in the Word, and we let that Word work on our hearts and our lives. Number four, the preacher or his family may feel the pressures to conform his message to what people want to hear. That's a timeless problem. Paul was at the end of his life, and he says to Timothy, who's working with the Ephesus church, in the last letter, so far as we know, that Paul would write. In 2 Timothy 4 and verse 3, he says, the time will come and they will not endure sound doctrine, but they will accumulate unto themselves teachers having itching ears. They'll turn their ears away from the truth, and they'll be turned unto fables. Not every time we get in the pulpit are we preaching something that we're excited about preaching. Last sermon I preached in local work was on church discipline because we're in process. I don't like to do that. And I hope it comes across that I don't enjoy it, but that I see the necessity of doing it. We've got to realize there are some things we preach that we don't want to preach and people don't want to hear, but we've got to preach them and we can't not preach them. Think about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. He died at the age of 36 and was buried in a pauper's grave. And when he died on that, and he was buried on that cold, rainy morning in Europe, thus ended the agony of the man and began the glory of the artist. And you begin to look into his life and you see that it was characterized by moral and relational chaos. He had some problems. But for all the problems with his character, there was one thing that was very close to his soul. And he once said, and part of the reason, according to legend, that he was buried in a pauper's grave was because of something that he said, or something that characterized him as a musician. He says, I will not play what they want to buy. I will play what I hear. When it comes to the kind of preaching that God wants us to do, what are we going to preach? Do we want to preach? Are we going to preach what we hear in the Word of God or what the people want to buy? You see, that's a pressure. That's a problem that we face. And so the preacher and his wife have got to be united in their submission to the will of God and declaring the whole counsel of God when it's popular and when it's not. We need to choose rather to suffer affliction with gospel preachers who are faithful rather than to enjoy the pleasures of pats on the back and attaboys for a season. Blessed is the preacher whose wife will help hold him accountable to holding forth the word of life and not the word of lies. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 16. So whatever the specific circumstances are, the preacher and his wife must be together, must be united when those problems come. We need to remember what Peter says to the husbands and wives in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. You husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way as with someone who is weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life so that your prayers will not be hindered. And I think Peter understood something about that, because he must have so lived his life so as to be qualified to serve as an elder. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 1. When I think back to 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, Leighton, for example, says that there are different layers in which a husband and wife may hold or cling to one another. He says it's a very dangerous thing when the love is built on physical attraction and beauty, because that soon molders and decays, and with that, the love. A higher and nobler objective is for the husband and wife to be united and to be in love in spirit and in mind. He said, but accidents may come and things will happen, and maybe the mind is taken away in older life. And again, that's not the highest motivation. But blessed is the one whose coming together is in recognition of Him before whom they live. In other words, blessed is that couple whose love is built on their spiritual relationship to God. Now that takes us to Ephesians chapter 5. If we love, and of course also Titus chapter 2, if each of us as husband and wife love in the way we're instructed to love, built on our relationship to God, it's going to last whenever the troubles come. Your ministry will be ironclad when you turn to each other and not on each other when there are problems. I love this poem. I don't know who it is that wrote it. There is one person in your church who knows your preacher's life. She's wept and smiled and prayed with him, and that's your preacher's wife. She knows the preacher's weakest point, knows his greatest power. She's heard him speak in trumpet tone in his great triumphant hour. She's heard him groaning in his soul when bitter raged the strife, as hand in his, she knelt with him, for she's a preacher's wife. The crowd has seen him in his strength, when gleamed his long-drawn sword, as underneath God's banner's folds he faced the devil's horde. But she knows deep within her heart that scarce an hour before, she helped him pray to God above behind the closet door. You tell your tales of prophets brave who walked across the world and changed the course of history by burning words they hurled. And I will tell you, back of them, some women lived their lives who wept with them and smiled with them. They are the preacher's wife. And, I almost did it again. Aquila and Priscilla were together in their problems. But second, this wonderful couple that we read about in the New Testament were not only together in their problems, they were together in the work. I was reading in preparation for this lesson a book by a British minister named Raymond Calkins, and the title caught my eye. The title of that book was The Romance of the Ministry. Started preaching in 1987. I don't think I have ever thought of it in that regard. The romance of the ministry? Guys, are you attracted to the romance of the ministry? Now, he, in setting up the book, said this about it. He said that the preacher doesn't loom as large in the community as he once did. He doesn't bulk as large. Says that he's no longer held intellectually and socially in the esteem that he once did, and men look down upon them, that they were once the bastions, the leaders of their community, but they're not seen so much in that way anymore. Now, what struck me was that he wrote that in 1944, almost 70 years ago. What has happened to the image and the character in the minds of people of the preacher in that intervening period of time? And there have been a lot of guys in the public scope, out in the denominational world, that have given the name of preacher a bad name. And there have been brethren who, because of their immorality and because of choices that they made, they hurt the character and reputation of preachers. But I think there is, as people get further away from God, an innate turn in trying to characterize the preacher, the human representative, as they see them, of a God whose will they don't want to submit to. And so they make them out to be a clown, or a buffoon, or a hypocrite, or a maladjusted neurotic. But Calkin, through the course of that book, mentioned some reasons why he's drawn to the romance of the ministry, and I like his summation of it at the end of the book. He says, here it is, to see the signs of inner progress, that is in me, the changes that I see because I've preached in myself, to see lives grow, to meet the sorrows of many people, to be persuaded of the reality of the influence that he can wield, to find himself drawn by the deep ties of spiritual affection, to have his days filled with duties that are perpetually fresh with all the sameness, to have the right of entrance to many homes and to many hearts, to find himself always confronted by tasks which are too great to be measured, and all the time to know the blessedness of human love, to have the memory of happy years. What more romantic life on earth can be lived than this. I never miss an opportunity to tell young people, to tell young preachers, to tell anybody who will listen to me, I love preaching. I wouldn't do anything else. I have found the thing that enriches my life. I love it. Wouldn't do anything else. But even if you think that Mr. Calkins is one of those guys who has that half glass full kind of a mentality, he's reminding us of some of the wonderful reasons why we do what we do and the eternally important nature of the work. Another preacher said, we are clay pots, but we are not crackpots. We are in His hands, and our flimsy words alter eternal realities. When a clay pot who is Scripture-saturated, prayer-armed, servant-hearted, God-adoring, and Christ-following speaks the Word of God, things happen, whether the preacher is aware of it or not. God smiles, angels applaud, hell quakes, and lives change. I've said all that to say, it doesn't surprise me when I see men come up to Bear Valley or go to Southwest or go to Memphis and enroll in a school of preaching. I understand. But the question I've more often asked is, why would a woman marry a preacher? Now guys, have you ever thought about that? I know I think about that with regard to myself personally. Why did Kathy marry me? She is a preacher's kid. She sees how a preacher and a preacher's wife are treated. You think about some of the things that we get to escape that falls more fully on them. You think about the heightened scrutiny that particularly, for some reason, the wife and mother is subjected to in raising children. Something unique that she has to bear. I also think about the fact that she often is in the shadow of her husband. You know, she also hears his words praised far more often than her own. She also bears the added difficulty because of the way God made a woman that it hurts her in a special way because she's a nurturer to see her husband's name or his character or his work attacked. Guys, I don't want to burst your bubble, but it's not because we're excessively good-looking and charismatic men that women are drawn to preachers. It says a lot about the special nature of women who make that choice. She must be special indeed to take on the extra challenges and to carry the burdens. Look through our library and I found books with some titles that tell you what it is, men, that wives sometimes go through in preaching, being married to a preacher. How about this? The Underground Manual for Ministers' Wives and Other Bewildered Women. How to Be a Minister's Wife and Love It. Different book. How to Be a Preacher's Wife and Like It. Maybe they should have gotten together and collaborated. And The Unprivate Life of a Preacher's Wife. It's a pretty good indication of the challenges that are unique in being a preacher's wife. Now what I want to point out to you is that Ananias and Sapphira were A and P were together. They had the same occupation. They were tent makers. They made their life together. They ate and they worked together as the result of the work that they did together. And what an example that is for a preacher and a preacher's wife. You can maintain closeness and fight off resentment and bitterness if you'll be looking at life as how you can be involved together. In the foyer, you're working together. In your home, you're working together. In members' homes, you're working together. In non-members' homes, you're working together. In mission work, you're working together. And in other phases of the local work, you get to work together. These co-workers of Paul, they were together. They were together in their problems, but they were also together in the work. But third, I want you to notice that they were together in evangelism. One religious survey found that 77% of church members believe that a preacher's wife must be able to know the Bible and to be able to teach it to others. I'm telling you what the expectation is. And while Scripture does not elevate the responsibility of a preacher's wife over that of any other Christian, she is an invaluable asset who loves souls and pursues them. Brethren, I want to be a little personal here. God has blessed me in an enormous way in this particular regard. I'm not sure that I know of a preacher who's a better soul winner than my wife is. I'm certain that in manner and in demeanor and in effectiveness, she is by far my superior in this regard. You know, I think I know that there aren't many people that are strangers to me, that I can talk to just about anybody. But the very common sense that drew me to Kathy is the kind of common sense that she has in a Bible study that has made her so effective. Perhaps it's the evangelism of Aquila and Priscilla that prompted this particular lesson today. We see them both at Corinth and at Syria with Paul. In the thick of things with Paul on the second missionary journey, we're going to see them again in Ephesus on the third missionary journey, teaching the mighty Apollos. But I want you to notice some things about this couple's evangelistic efforts that serve as an example for us today. And there's going to be a handout after this, and there's some additional things that I thought of after the fact. But number one, listening was a key element to their evangelism. You notice in verse 26, and if you want to turn to Acts 18, 24 to 28, especially 26, this is where this comes from. Number one, they heard him. You notice that preceded their teaching him. And so they knew that listening was key to evangelism. So often in evangelism, we're wanting to tell somebody what they need to do and not listen to where they are particularly. What if Paul had gone and preached the same sermon on Mars Hill that he preached on Pentecost? He was able to get an idea of what was going on first. Number two, tact was a key element of their evangelism. What did they do? They raked him over the coals publicly, right? No, they took him aside. See, they were sensitive to how he might feel and what might be the best forum in which to teach him. Number three, clear communication was an aspect of their evangelism that made it effective. We see that they explained to him the way of God more accurately. They didn't make presumptions and assumptions as they taught. But also we see, number four, that vision was a key element of their evangelism. Context seems to imply that. They saw a great man with great passion for the Lord who didn't understand the Word of God correctly. They might have thrown up their hands. They might have given up. But instead, they led him to the truth, and the church gained one of its most eloquent preachers. Of all the wonderful things that a preacher and his wife can do together in the course of their ministry life, none, it seems to me, can exceed the thrill of evangelism. You may have to overcome your own bashfulness. You may have to overcome your own feelings of inadequacy. You may have to overcome your fear, your lack of confidence in your ability to execute a particular method. But you overcome that and you do it together, then your life is going to be blessed. Just a very quick aside, I was teaching evangelism not long ago in the congregation. And in the course of that, I was about to go, and then I went and preached in a meeting in south of Albuquerque. And there's a man down there nobody's ever heard of. His name's Hud Griffith. He's a power plant operator. And Hud is, last year, 2009, he was responsible for over 20 conversions. And already almost half a dozen this year. I just don't encounter that very often. And he believes and he understands the truth on things like marriage, divorce, and remarriage. He's not watering it down. And so I wanted to know, what can I tell this class that I'm teaching on how to be that kind of powerful soul winner? And I was ready to write down pages and pages of notes. And he said, Neil, here's how I do it right here. He said, I go up to a person and here's what I say to them. Would you like to study the Bible with me? That's it. I mean, it's got to be more complex than that. I can't tell them that. I got 45 minutes. That's it. I know it's true. Think back in your own life when you get Bible studies up. You go up to somebody and say, I've been trying to find somebody to study the Bible with. Would you be willing to study the Bible with me? Yes, sometimes they may embarrass you, humiliate you, but that's going to be so minor, so infrequent. Usually they're going to say, absolutely, I want to. Or at least they'll say, yes, I'm willing. Maybe we let the devil drive us to fear with regard to that. But a husband and wife united, what a powerful team they're going to be. Number four, Aquila and Priscilla were united in sacrifice. You know, the Bible doesn't say how Aquila and Priscilla risked their necks for Paul, but there are some things to consider. They had seen Paul in peril. They had seen him put his life on the line, and they had been with him. Doug McClish in the Denton Lecture said, they witnessed the mob action in Corinth when Paul was drugged before Gallio. They were in Ephesus when Demetrius stirred up the violence that threatened Paul's life. The fact that all the churches of the Gentiles gave thanks for their sacrifice shows that the incident was widely known. Ask yourself the question, what will you be called on to sacrifice as a preacher and wife? Maybe your personal comfort. Might be your financial security. You may have to sacrifice certain friendships. You may have to sacrifice some relationships that are harmful to your faith and your influence. You might have to sacrifice your physical safety, your dignity, or any number of things. But in many cases, such sacrifices are going to be made known to others, and it's going to help them in their lives. Don't you think about Paul in Philippians chapter 1 and verses 12 through 14 when he talks about what happened as the result of his having been in prison? He's trying to get Iodius and Syntyche to be of the same mind, and he gives all these examples. And I don't think it's arrogant of Paul to use himself as an example of having the right kind of mind, a mind that looks for the things of others, not the things of self. And he says, as a result of this, there are people who are being impressed because of the sacrifices that I'm enduring, because I'm behind this prison cell that's giving me access to folks. And there are folks who are bold to preach the gospel because they see what I'm going through. When your mindset is to be a sacrificing couple for the Lord, you are going to impact others. You're going to be living proof of the power of Christ. Hebrews 13 and 1 Peter chapter 2. And don't worry how much others see how deeply you're sacrificing. God sees it all. And you are working for one who can reward you openly and more generously than you could even imagine. Fifth, Aquila and Priscilla were those who worked together in hospitality. They opened their homes to the church, which met in their home, in Rome and in Corinth at least. And Banks says of this that the entertaining room in a moderately well-to-do household could hold around 30 people comfortably. And some scholars believe that all those names that Paul mentions in Romans chapter 16 were members of the church at Rome. And if it was, then they had a house that was perhaps much larger than that. They might have been some of the wealthiest people in the church in the first century, but they used that to the glory of God. Morris says they evidently had a habit of using their home in the service of the Lord. They housed Paul in Acts 18:1-3. And Linsky points out that some codices in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 19, speaking of Paul, add that of Aquila and Priscilla, that they housed me. You will find that opening up your home together is going to aid your ministry life so greatly. It'll be a source of true joy and lasting memories. As you work together to build relationships with those who come into your home, as you eat together, and as you study together, and as you're doing the dishes together when it's all said and done, you're going to see the great depth that's added to your life because you were hospitable together. You know, something happens when you have people in your home. It changes. You know, when you go to work somewhere, to begin local work in a location, work as aggressively as you can to have people in your home, because when you see them at services the next time, there's a different relationship than you had before that. And it will enrich your ministry. You know, there are three passages that command all Christians to be involved in hospitality. Romans 12:13, Hebrews 13 and verse 2, and 1 Peter 4 and verse 9. But as it usually is the case, if not always, when God gives us a command, He is blessing our lives if we'll obey it. You enrich your own life and you understand what Jesus meant when He said it's more blessed to give than to receive. Acts 20, verse 35. But then six, Aquila and Priscilla were together in service. You know, Herman Wilson wrote the book, The Preacher and the Seven-Day Week, and he had several aspects of the preacher's life, and even though this was 33 years ago, he included a chapter in it by a Christian woman about the preacher's other self, the wife. The whole chapter, I think, is a great read. But in it, she says, the preacher's wife should seek to be a servant. She ought not covet the prominent place, but be willing, like Martha, to serve in the kitchen, the nursery, the clothing room, or anywhere her talents and opportunities dictate. If she says yes to opportunities, God will make of her what He wants her to be. Her willingness to work without fanfare or seeking credit will have a beneficent influence on others. My observation, most preachers, we're talking about sound gospel preachers, excel in preparing Bible classes and sermons. And they're good studiers. But they have lost sight of a great part of what they're supposed to be doing. They don't know how to interact with people. It's a fundamental flaw. Now, I realize that some are more introverted by their nature and have to work harder to overcome it. But I can guarantee you that people will not hear what you say till they see your service. till they see you living out the principles that you're trying to preach Sunday after Sunday. When you show and demonstrate that you care about them, if you can establish that by serving them, there is not a subject, no matter how difficult it may seem, that you can't preach if you've been involved in people's lives. If you have been there when they've been sick, if you've been there when their children are born and when they go to die, or some great family problem comes up, or in the good times, if you're there. But you see, that involves service. You know, a preacher has got to develop the ability to say, I will serve. I will show up for the door knockings. I'll show up for the work days. Not for a token 10, 15 minutes. I'll be there. Yes, I know I've got to preach tomorrow, and I'm going to have to stay up extra late and get up extra early in the morning to make sure that I have that thing fine and polished off, but I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there at times and not grouse about it if I have to be the one to cut off the lights and lock the building. I'm going to be involved in benevolent works. I'm going to roll up my sleeves, and people aren't going to think of me as some preacher that's up in an ivory tower that's never involved. And you see, the husband and wife can do that together. Aquila and Priscilla were those who were sacrificial and servant-minded. They said, we have a house. Let's open it up. Paul's going to Syria. Let's go with him. Let's be involved. Well, time is getting away from us. Let me conclude. David Mace understood the danger of neglecting one's marriage relationship, even if it's for a good reason. He said this. He said, one of the great illusions of our time is that love is self-sustaining. It's not. Love must be fed and nurtured, constantly renewed. That demands ingenuity and consideration, but first and foremost, it demands time. The preacher must spend time with his wife because love cannot be neglected or they'll die. The wise preacher looks for ways to include his wife in his preaching life. And for that matter, his children, but that's a subject for tomorrow. In the book, Men of the Pauline Circle, the author says, neither Luke nor Paul ever thinks of either of these apart from the other. Their names are as truly wedded as their lives are. Let's spend our ministry so that people, when they think of us, think of our mates and not just of us. I am proud for the congregation and for the brotherhood to know my wife. Not just because she's beautiful and it causes people to say, wow, what did he do? It's more than that. The more people that are exposed to Kathy, the more lives I know will be impacted and blessed like she's blessed mine. The church doesn't need more Ananias and Sapphiras, but they do need more Aquilas and Priscillas who are dedicated to serving hand in hand as their ministry life is lived together. Thank you very much.